The nation of America has been one of the greatest nations that this world has ever seen. It has been a significant player in the affairs of mankind for nearly 200 years. This nation had built the Panama Canal, for example, a massive undertaking and a really just an awesome achievement. This nation turned the tide of World War II and saved millions from death by the fascist regime of Germany. This nation has helped numerous other peoples around the world who were suffering from war, from famine, from natural disasters and disease. And there are just really too many things to list. America, for example, was the first to put two men, on the moon and to bring them home safely from another sphere in our atmosphere or in our solar system. And so there are so many things that America has done that are very great, that have benefited many people around the world, not just this country, whether it comes to achievements in medicine or industry or economics or assistance in difficult times. And because of America's significance, some believe that this nation will be a significant player in end time events. And it is taught by some that America, in fact, is the beastly empire of the book of Revelation. Could this be true? Is there legitimate evidence to support such a theory? And what is the biblical and historical evidence that is contrary, actually, to such a belief? I think it is something worth and important to some degree to understand. So let's go over to Jeremiah in chapter 30, Jeremiah 30, to begin the message from the Bible there. The Middle East seems to have consistently been a hotbed of violent activity. And for thousands of years, tribes, nations, people of various tongues have fought with one another in the territory of and surrounding the area of what is called the land of Canaan or the Promised Land. Now, the Bible prophesied that this hostile activity will lead to a conflict that will appear to be like a World War III. But before this skirmish escalates, it's prophesied that a powerful empire will arise on the world scene and will dominate the world. And this empire will be led by a charismatic leader that the Bible calls the man of sin and son of perdition. Now, many have speculated about this man of sin and the empire that he will lead. Some, in fact, leaders of a Church of God group and some members of this group have taught that the man of sin actually will be a minister in the Church of God. And others that this man of sin will rise up from the melting pot of the United States of America. And there are several reasons why both of these cannot be true. And I won't go into the first. There was a sermon given about that a couple years back about the man of sin. But the first reason to understand that the man of sin could not be an individual that rises up in power in the United States of America is because of the prophesied time of Jacob's trouble spoken of by the prophet Jeremiah. And so the prophecy that we are about to read foretells of a time when a nation or nations that carry Jacob's name and his birthright blessing, which we'll see in just a moment, will experience persecution on a scale that has not been seen since the time that the Jews experienced the Holocaust of World War II. And so let's look at that for a moment. Jeremiah 30 and verse 5. For thus says the Eternal, we have heard a voice of trembling, of fear, and not of peace. And ask now and see whether a man is ever in labor with child. Is that such a possible? Is it possible for a man to be in labor with a child? No, not a man. Only woman. So why then do I see every man with his hands on his loins like a woman in labor and all faces turned pale? And so we see that it is talking about a time when many, many people are suffering greatly, possibly from hunger pangs, grabbing their stomach with severe pains, and their faces pale from lack of sustenance, almost to the point of death. And could it be that this is describing the black horse or of famine, combined also with the pale horse, I think. In any case, it goes on to say in verse 7, "Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it." None. Nothing. And we haven't seen anything on this scale since World War II. "And it is the time," it says, "of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it." So how can we know exactly what people it is that will face this time of great trouble? Time of Jacob's trouble. And what we can know by understanding the prophetic birthright blessing that was bestowed upon the sons of Joseph by Jacob, also known as Israel. And if you put a ribbon here in Jeremiah 30, because we are going to come back to Jeremiah 30, but go all the way back to Genesis in chapter 48. Now, for some people, this might be a bit of review, and the sermon today will be a little bit technical, but I'm hoping to simplify it so that people can understand. And some of the things that I will mention are given with the idea that we have an understanding about these subjects, a basic understanding. Even those that teach or believe that America is the beast have an understanding of some of these things. And so, after Joseph had rose to prominence in the land of Egypt, becoming second in command to Pharaoh, and he saved that nation from certain destruction if it were not for God working with Joseph, he brought his family, his brothers and his father, down into Egypt, and his family was given some of the choicest land in Egypt, the land of Goshen. And they prospered in this area, and they grew to become a great people. But before they had swelled in their numbers, Jacob had gotten very old, and he was sick, and he knew that the time was coming that he would die. And so he called his progeny to him to give them a blessing. Now, Jacob's blessing was not merely something that Jacob desired for his children to experience, to have. No, these were inspired words by God, and they are prophetic. And if we read through them, we see how those nations that we understand, the nations that these tribes had become, they were fulfilled. And so we're only going to speak of one of his blessings upon Joseph. If you look at Genesis 48, and we will begin reading in verse 13, it says that Joseph took, he's talking about his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right hand. And he brought them near to his father, Jacob. And then Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph through his two sons here, and said, "God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Let my name be upon them, and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." Now when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, so he took his hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, "Not so, my father, for this is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head." So it was a tradition that the right hand would go to the firstborn, and he would receive that blessing. But his father refused and said, "I know, my son, I know. Speaking of Manasseh, he shall become a people, a great people, in other words. He shall be great, but truly his younger brother, Ephraim, shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations." And so we see that Joseph's two sons, as it says, had Jacob's name placed upon them, the name of Israel and of Jacob. And it says that they would become a great, or two great nations, and one of them would become a multitude of nations. And this is prophetic of Great Britain, who over centuries had become a great name. Well, look at the size of that country. But they had become a great people, forming nations all around the world, in Ireland and Scotland and Australia and New Zealand and others, colonizing many places of the earth. And so let's go back to Jeremiah 30. Jeremiah 30. Now, think for a moment. Let's consider the context of Jeremiah's prophecy. Because Jeremiah's ministry had taken place some 100 years after the prophet Isaiah. And the prophet Isaiah was sent to the house of Israel, to the northern tribes, to tell them what would happen when Assyria would come down and destroy that nation, kill many people, and take away those who survived as slaves, and they would be spread out around the earth eventually. And so the house of Israel had already suffered great calamity when Jeremiah began his work. And Jeremiah was sent to the house of Judah to tell them what would come upon Judah from Babylon. And so the time of Jacob's trouble that Jeremiah speaks of in chapter 30, it's not the prophet retelling what happened to the house of Israel, you know, some 100 years prior. No, this prophecy was for the future. And we can know this by looking at the continued words in verse 8, Jeremiah 30 and verse 8. For it shall come to pass, after it says that it's the time of Jacob's trouble, he shall be saved out of it. Then it shall come to pass in that day, says the Lord of hosts, that I will break his yoke from your neck. I will burst your bonds. Foreigners shall no more enslave them, and they shall serve the Eternal their God, and David their king, whom I will raise up for them. And so we see that God will save those, eventually, those who carry the name of Jacob or Israel. He will bring them back to their land after David is raised up, raised from the dead, in other words. And we see what he is talking about David being set up as a king over the 12 tribes of Israel, as it is said in other prophecies. And so King David's resurrection hasn't taken place yet. As Christ said, no one has ascended to heaven except for the man that came down from heaven, which is Jesus Christ. And so King David's resurrection will not take place until when? The last trumpet. The last trumpet plague is blown. And so we know that King David is one of the chosen saints who will return with Christ, who will work with Christ and the rest of the saints to establish God's kingdom on the earth. And so who then are these people that Jeremiah spoke of who experienced the time of Jacob's trouble? Well, obviously there are people related to Israel. And we see from the birthright prophecy that these people would be a multitude of nations and a great nation in the midst of the earth. This gives us a clue as to who these people are. And so a thorough and spirit-led study of history, of the history of nations in the compared to the Bible, has shown that the nations of Great Britain and the United States of America are the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. And this was proven by J.H. Allen, who wrote a book called Judah's Scepter and Joseph's Birthright, and also an expounded work on what J.H. Allen had done by Herbert W. Armstrong, who wrote The United States and Britain in Prophecy. So the United States of America and Britain are the two nations that will experience the time of Jacob's trouble. Some other nations will likely be involved because of their connection to Great Britain, such as Australia and New Zealand, and perhaps others. And therefore, for this reason, America cannot be the beastly end-time empire of the book of Revelation. That final head, as described in the book, of the prophetic beast will be a source of trouble to the world. It will not be a victim of the calamity, at least until the year of God's wrath begins. And we'll hear more about that in the sermon on Monday. And so let's go over to Daniel now, Daniel and chapter 7. Another reason that the United States of America cannot be the beast of Revelation is because of the description of that beast found in the book of Revelation, having seven heads. And so the seven heads of that beast represent seven eras of an empire that has existed, well, it has existed since the time of the prophet Daniel. And so Daniel had a vision of four beasts, and he wrote about it in chapter 7 of his book, and he describes in verse 4 of chapter 7, this beast that was like a lion having eagle's wings, but its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And so it's understood that this empire that he described as a beast like a lion was the Babylonian Empire. And this empire ripped and tore at the nations as it conquered. But eventually, it stood on 2 feet like a man. A man's heart was given to it, it said. And it could be that this is describing the fact that Nebuchadnezzar had his heart softened by God when he declared himself to have done all this work. And God humbled him for 7 years, making him become like an animal, living like an animal for 7 years. And it's documented, in fact, one of the only passages in the Bible of a quote-unquote unbeliever claiming that God is God, that the God of Israel is a God, and he is powerful, and he should be glorified. And that's written by Nebuchadnezzar in the book of Daniel. But in any case, the next dominant empire described by the prophet Daniel is in verse 5. It's a beast that's like a bear, and it has 3 ribs in its mouth. And this empire was a combined forces of the Medes and the Persians. And they were the next to follow. They were the ones that conquered the Babylonian Empire. And the 3 ribs in the bear's mouth represent Babylon, Lydia, and Egypt, which were 3 significant nations or empires that the Medes and the Persians had conquered. Now, the next beast that Daniel described is in verse 6, and it's a leopard that had wings on its back, and the beast also had 4 heads, kind of quite an unusual leopard, having 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. And this leopard represents the Greco-Macedonian Empire of Alexander the Great. And the 4 heads represent the fact that after the death of Alexander, his 4 generals quartered the empire, and they took control each of a section. And that's represented in this third beast here. Now, the fourth beast, and I'm not going into all the details, but again, I want to reiterate, some of this of what I'm saying is given with the idea that we've studied this out and we know these things. It's written in our literature. We've talked about it many times. And if anybody needs further understanding, we have books, several books and booklets like Keys to Understanding Revelation, Understanding the Mark of the Beast, Evidence for Eras. These booklets go into further detail about these subjects. In any case, the fourth beast was different from all the rest, and it represented the powerful Roman Empire. Now, all of these beasts, the reason I quickly went through them, all of these beasts are represented in the end time beast of Revelation in chapter 13. That in verse 2, it says that that beast was like a leopard, had feet of a bear, had the mouth like the mouth of a lion. And it says, and the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority. And so we see then that John's vision of the end time beast of Revelation describes an empire that conquered all others in its work. Yeah, sorry for that. I should just not bring the phone down here. Just turn it off. In any case, this empire that conquered all others in its region cannot be describing the United States of America. Such a feat has not happened with this great nation. In addition, the seven heads of the beast of Revelation perfectly match eras of the Roman Empire that began with Justinian in 527 AD. And so when we compare the seven eras of that empire, this has actually no meaning. The seven heads has no meaning for the history of the United States or even of Great Britain. Now, related to the seven heads is the fact that one of them was mortally wounded, and Revelation 13:3 says that the deadly wound was healed. Now, this may refer to the fall of the Roman Empire in 476 AD and then its revival by the Emperor Justinian. That's likely the case, but it is possible that the mortal wound that was healed could be referring to the fascist era of Hitler and Mussolini, which the empire seemed to be entirely destroyed at the end of World War II, but it will revive. That empire will revive. And this was pointed out in a sermon that I'd given several months ago about Assyria and Germany and prophecy. In either case, the prophecy of one head being mortally wounded and the wound being healed has no meaning for the United States of America or of Great Britain. These nations have never experienced a deadly wound that collapsed the nation. Let's go over a few pages to Daniel 11. Daniel 11. Another reason that the United States of America cannot be the beast of Revelation is because of an extensive and detailed prophecy recorded by the prophet Daniel in the 11th chapter here. And this is, well, arguably one of the most detailed prophecies in the entire Bible. And it foretells of an empire called the King of the North that not only rose to power, but the prophet chronicles many of the details of war and of plunder and of political maneuvering of that empire. Now, well, the first half, and it's really a long chapter. In fact, there was two Bible studies given on this chapter that is in our library and that are very detailed Bible studies. And I'm not going to go through most of this chapter, but I'm going to go through a few parts here to make the point. Because, well, the first half of the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, it details the Seleucid Empire of Antiochus IV Epiphanes. And this began in 175 BC. And partway through this chapter, there's an amazing parallel that begins of this blasphemous leader, Antiochus Epiphanes, who hated the Jews, he hated God's religion, and it foretells how this individual will be mimicked by an end-time leader of the beast of Revelation, who is the man of sin, the son of perdition. And the parallel becomes clear, I think, in verse 31, where it says that forces shall be mustered by him, this king of the north, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress, and they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation, a very familiar phrase that we have heard many times when referring to prophecy. Now, in 167 BC, Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, conquered Jerusalem, and he desecrated the temple after killing so many people in this land. And Josephus wrote about this in his Chronicles, where he wrote in, I guess it's the 12th chapter of Josephus, and 5.4, he said that when the king, speaking of Antiochus, had built an idol altar upon God's altar in the temple, he slew swine upon it and so offered a sacrifice, neither according to the law nor the Jewish religious worship in that country. And he also compelled them to forsake the worship which they had paid to their own God and to adore those whom he took to be gods. And he made them build temples and raise idol altars in every city and village and offered swine upon them every day. And this is just a part of what Antiochus Epiphanes did. He did horrible things to those people, to God's people in the land of Jerusalem or Judea. And so the point is the abomination of desolation took place hundreds of years after Daniel had written the prophecy in the book of, or in chapter 11. But the prophecy was not entirely fulfilled during the time of Antiochus the Fourth. And so if you have a ribbon, put it here in Daniel 11, and I would like you to turn over to Matthew 24 for just a moment. I think you know where I'm going with this, because there is an obvious indication of end-time events when we consider Daniel's prophecy along with the words of Christ who revealed signs of the end time. And so Christ was specifically asked by his disciples, what will be the sign of the end and of your second coming? And his response, one of his responses to this question, points to the scripture that we had just read in Daniel chapter 11, Matthew 24, 15. He says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. And there's more detail given to that particular event. But the point is, this is a clear reference to the book of Daniel. And it was already established in Daniel's prophecy that Antiochus the Fourth was a king of northern territories. He was a king of the north, north of Judea. And he did wickedly. And this king had a volatile relationship with the king of the south, a nation south of the king of the north, which during the time of Antiochus Epiphanes was Egypt, the Egyptian Empire. Now, something to always remember in regards to prophecies such as these is that they are related to us from a sense of Judea or Jerusalem being a central point. And therefore, the king of the north, the northern empire, was north of Jerusalem, being in the locations, the modern-day locations of Italy and throughout Europe. The king of the south was an empire south of that area, and southwest, technically, of Jerusalem, being Egypt, and stretching even down into Africa, which was the Egyptian Empire, a great Arabic people. Genesis 17, Genesis in chapter 17. Arabs have long been a great people. The Arab people are descendants of Abraham. And God, in fact, promised that they would be a great nation, or nations, plural. In Genesis 17, and verse 20, well, let's go begin reading in verse 18. Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. But God said, no, Sarah, your wife, shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his descendants after him. And as for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him, and will make him fruitful, and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall beget 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. And so when Ishmael grew and became a man, he took a wife from the land of Egypt. And this is shown in Genesis 20:20. And we see the connection then with Egypt and the Arab people. But there would be a consistent struggle among the Arab brethren. And this was prophesied by God, prophesied to Hagar before she gave birth to Ishmael. Look at this in chapter 16 of Genesis, in verse 10. The angel of the Eternal said to her, speaking to Hagar, I will multiply your descendants exceedingly, so that they shall not be counted for multitude. And the angel of the Eternal said to her, behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Eternal has heard your affliction. Ye shall be a wild man, or stubborn man, not cooperative. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. And this refers to conflicts that his descendants would have among their own relatives. Genesis 27. So 12 tribes came from Ishmael. And, you know, it's interesting that 12 tribes came from Jacob or Israel. Some of these became great nations. And interestingly, Esau, the brother of, the brother of Jacob, he, or Esau, was given a similar birthright blessing, similar to that of Ishmael. In Genesis 27, and again, consider that these birthright blessings were not given just because the father or mother wanted them to have God's blessing. These were given by inspiration of God. They were prophetic. Genesis 27, in verse 39, then Isaac his father answered and said to him, speaking to Esau, behold, your dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven from above. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. And it shall come to pass when you become restless that you shall break his yoke from your neck. So Esau had a similar blessing that he would become a great people, but he would be at war much of the time. Conflict. And he would serve other nations, and his people have for many, many centuries. Esau married a woman by the name of Mahalath. Now, Mahalath was a descendant of Ishmael. And from these two men, a variety of Arab states have risen down through the ages. At one time, the Arabs amassed an empire called the Arab Caliphate. That empire stretched from the Atlantic Ocean all the way into India in the West. It was the world's largest empire ever. But it could not remain united. And I think it's because of this infighting and this disagreement within the Arab tribes. Now today, the dominant Arab religion is Islam. Islam understands and teaches that the Jews are their cousins. But Muslims believe that Allah rejected the Jews, threw them out of the promised land, and that Allah intended for their people, the Arab people, to inhabit that land, those people that are descendants of Ishmael and Esau. Islam teaches that a leader is going to be sent by Allah, a man they call a Mahdi, and this man will come shortly before the coming of the Messiah. Their prophecies say that the Mahdi will come and he will destroy a false Messiah. He will unite the Muslims all under one flag, and they will practice a pure form of Islam at that time. And so the Islamic terrorism that is happening and has been happening for centuries around the world is an attempt to make way for the Mahdi to come. Now, the overall strength of the Arab people is comparatively weak when considering the other nations around the world, and partly it's because they are so divided. And yet they are still a significant people, aren't they? There are 22 Arab countries today around the world, consisting of 400 million people who have Arabic blood. The number of Arabs worldwide is much larger when we consider those who dwell in other nations. And though many of their people in these 22 countries, the common people, I should say, many of them are poor, the economic wealth of Arabs is enormous. And they have been responsible for a great many achievements, such as in medicine, in math, and in industry. And so God has blessed those people to a large degree because of his promise to Hagar, to Ishmael, and to Esau. And these people will play a significant role in end time events. But what role will that be? Well, considering, let's consider the continuing prophecy of Daniel 11. Let's go back to Daniel. Should have told you to put your ribbon there if I did not. Go ahead and have a ribbon here in Daniel 11. History and the first half of chapter 11 established the king of the south coming from the area of Egypt. Antiochus Epiphanes fought with this ancient king, empire of the south, who had a great army, but the army could not stand against the king of the north. In like manner, the king of the south will rise once again, and it will create conflict within a mighty northern empire that will exist in this same region. Daniel 11 and verse 40, at that time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and horsemen with many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through them. So something will cause the king of the south to attack northern interests. And the king of the north will come down with great strength and will plow through these areas that are inhabited or attacked by the king of the south. And this makes it obvious when we look at the context, when we look at history and the duality in the prophecies, that the king of the south refers to an Arabic people who have united to form a significant military force. In fact, their unification is prophesied to occur. Let's look at Psalm and verse 83. Chapter 83. Psalm chapter 83. Psalm 83, Psalm of Asaph, a prophetic psalm, in verse 1. Do not keep silent, O God. Do not hold your peace, and do not be still, O God. For behold, your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their head. They have taken crafty counsel against your people and consulted together against your sheltered ones, or some translations say hidden ones. They have said, come, let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be remembered no more. Does that sound familiar to something that many of the Arab people say today? They want to cut off the Jews in Israel from being a nation, claiming that Allah has forsaken them. And verse 5, for they have consulted together with one consent. They form a confederacy against you. And then it goes on to describe the people that can form this confederacy: the tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagrites, Gebal, Ammon and Amalek, Philistia, with the inhabitants of Tyre. And these are all Arab peoples. All of these are Arab nations. But this confederacy is not just with Arab nations. Assyria has joined with them, and they have helped the children of Lot. And so we see that there is this volatile relationship at some point between the king of the north and the king of the south, just like it was in the past when it came to Antiochus and the empire of Egypt. And something causes them to be hostile with one another. And that is prophesied to happen once again. And so we see that the confederacy takes place in an attempt to cut off God's people. And a type of this, you know, that some may argue that this already happened. And I will admit, a type could have happened to a degree, to a small degree, I think, when the Arab Caliphate was in existence. But the Jews, think about it, the Jews and Israel had long been scattered before the Arab Caliphate Empire. And so it's our understanding that the fulfillment of this scripture of Daniel 11 and of Psalm 83 is yet to come. So let's go back to Daniel 11 for a moment. We're going to be wrapping it up here in a few more minutes. So we have a prophecy of a prominent northern empire fighting with a significant southern empire in the Middle East. And the point I am making in all of this is that Daniel was not prophesying of North America fighting with South America. That's not even an option in this prophecy. This king of the north, as Daniel wrote in verse 41, shall enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. And this is talking about people in Turkey and modern-day Jordan. Some of those will escape. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But, and again, this is the future, news from the east and the north shall trouble him, and therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And it's our understanding that this is talking about news coming from Asia and Russia. It's going to trouble him. What's happening there? And it's likely referring to the gathering of the 200 million man army in Revelation chapter 9. But it also says that this man of sin shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. And it's talking about Jerusalem, about him having setting up a headquarters in this area between the Mediterranean and the holy mountain. And yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. And so I do hope that some of these things that I discussed in this message help some of us to understand that we should not be looking for a man of sin to rise up out of the people of America, out of the Church of God, as some teach. Simply because the man of sin comes from among a people doesn't mean that the man of sin rises up from among we the people. Something that, you know, refers to America's founding fathers, words written in the Constitution. 1 John in chapter 1, I'm going to end there. 1 John 1. Those who claim that the United States of America is the end time beast of Revelation say this. They say that the United States of America fits the pattern of violent military power and economic, political, religious propaganda machine that demands the allegiance of its citizens. This is not true. The propaganda spread by the nation of America is diversity, not unity. Its citizens have a wide agenda. From some have a religious agenda, some have a sexual agenda, some have a political agenda. America does not demand allegiance of its citizens. No, it says, come as you are, come on in, bring your culture, bring your religion, whatever with you, bring it in. And because of this mixed bag of beliefs found in the melting pot of America, some have said that, you know, you and I live in a modern-day Babylon where religion is corrupt and commerce is corrupt and politics are corrupt. And this is true, but it's true of every nation on the earth, isn't it? In fact, America's moral degradation doesn't mean that America is the Babylon of Revelation. Many nations are actually far worse than America in these deviancies. And all this information presented today can be helpful. Something that we should need to understand as well is that this is in itself and is not a salvational issue. You know, we don't have to believe that the man of sin is going to head a Roman Empire in order to be saved. But this could become a salvational issue if we allow those individuals that claim that America is the beast of Revelation to lead us astray in other ways. Because if such people are wrong about this issue, what other things are they saying that might be wrong? And so I encourage us to rightly divide the word of truth, to prove all things, to hold fast to those things that are good as we study the scriptures. Don't seek to satisfy itching ears with words that some people are saying that we might want to hear, that in our little heart of hearts we agree with, but we can't prove it. False teachers may be charismatic. They may be animated. They may have elements of truth in some of the things that they say, but when we closely examine everything they say, we'll find inaccuracies. As the Apostle John warned in 1 John, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits, whether they are of God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. And so beware, prove all things." And let's keep trying to be accounted worthy to escape those things that shall come to pass when the beast of Revelation rises its ugly head and the man of sin is revealed.